Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Sonia Sepabon, currently the CEO of Our Office, Inc., a leader in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. Prior to Our Office, Sonia was a senior executive with significant responsibilities at Fortune 500 companies in the aerospace and defense sector. Tune in to discover, first, curiosity leads to better outcomes. Sonia's story shows that fostering curiosity creates a richer learning environment and helps people explore new opportunities. Second, data is key to DEIB success. Using data to identify gaps and biases makes diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging initiatives more effective. And finally, sustainability requires structure. To make DEIB progress last, organizations need to build these initiatives into their core systems. Without proper infrastructure, even well-intentioned efforts can unravel when leadership changes or priorities shift. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by Sonia Sepabon. Sonia is the founder, CEO, champion, and ally over at Our Office, which is a great platform we're going to learn more about today. But she's also a chemical engineer and had aspirations of being an astronaut and worked for some really cool businesses along the way. So it's going to be wonderful diving into your story, Sonia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dane. It's been so much fun getting to know you as well.
It's going to be cool. It's just before the show, you were telling me how you wanted to be an astronaut from a young age and you tried multiple times. You even worked for NASA. So maybe we start there and you tell us like how that journey led you to the great work that you're doing today.
Sure. I like to say that I'm an astronaut wannabe, right? And yes, as I was a small child, my earliest memories that are, if you will, career related, are when I saw clips of the moon landing. I said that I wanted to do that. And to my parents, amazement, maybe also they were a little bit concerned because at that time, obviously, space was not like today, when we even have civilians actually on a private mission going even out in space, right?
Which yeah.
That happened recently. And that is quite an achievement, right? It's a very, very hard thing to do in the harsh environment of space to go out in a spacesuit. So we've come a very long way. But at that time, this was not something most kids say, like, I want to be a firefighter, you know?
Yeah.
So I pursued that. And I say a wannabe because I did try a few times. Even though I worked at NASA for a number of years, I had the pleasure of really working with a very interesting group of people, astronauts, obviously, and the people that made the missions possible. And what I found, the one thing that I found that I really love to this day, my time at NASA is one of my most cherished times, is that everybody was curious. Everybody wanted to know why, how. And that's exactly how I've been. And I didn't feel silly being like that. So I would say that the theme that connects everything in my past, and it starts with that, so thank you for bringing that up, is just curiosity. As we were saying before we started here, if we're all more curious or took the time to be more curious, because everybody can be, obviously, we would have a better world probably.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. It would be exciting. I think it's in reach too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. We'd have richer experiences, all of us. There's often things I've wondered about that at the time, my family has wondered why I was veering off into something and exploring it only later on for everyone to say, especially on trips. You know, when we go on trips, we like to go to distant places sometimes with my family. And sometimes they think it's a diversion, but then everybody has a richer experience as a result.
Love it. Love it. And as you then went on into larger, more executive roles around engineering, product development, When did you really start building this expertise and sort of mission around the diversity, equity, and inclusivity, belonging?
Yeah, you know, it's very strange because, you know, I was, I grew up a tomboy. I had the two brothers. I hung out. I did everything, you know, sports, you know, skiing, all kinds of things, you know, with mostly male friends.
Yeah.
So I didn't really think of me. I wasn't a girly girl. I didn't think of myself as a, I guess in my identity, I did not think of myself first and foremost, you know, as a girl or as a woman. I always hung out with boys. I was always climbing walls and on trees and sometimes doing some extreme sports a little bit,
yeah,
a little bit too adventurous. So it really wasn't until much later when I was actually given a role that was along these lines. I mean, even in college, I didn't belong to the Society of Women Engineers. I was, mm-hmm. And it's not to say that, I mean, obviously now I think those are very important, important endeavors and organizations that help support women. And I believe that all, you know, groups need communities. We all need community, no matter who we are and where we are. But at the time, it was just not something that was part of my focus. And then even in work, you know, and most of the major organizations I was at, I was just, you know, just an engineer. And and I grew,
yeah,
grew that way. And I did a lot of things. Again, mostly I was the only one. But when I went in my last role, you know, at a major organization at GD, I was actually told that I was the first woman ever in the C-suite. And I was asked how I felt about that. And that was just struck me as a very odd question.
It is.
And this was after they had made me an offer I had accepted. And we were having a strategy conversation before I actually went to, you know, start work. And I paused a moment because I had not really reflected on that. And then what occurred to me is I just said, you know, I feel fine. Obviously, I've been a woman all my life and I've been in, yeah, some roles. So I'm quite, this is quite familiar to me and I'm quite fine with it. And then I asked my boss at that time, I said, but how do you feel about that? And, you know, he laughed and he said that his wife had actually encouraged him.
Good.
And, in this regard. And so anyway, and it worked out well. A few years later, they told me that since I worked out, they would hire a second woman. So I guess that worked out fine. But again, later in that same role, but later on, they gave me an added responsibility of focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion. This was in the 2009-2010 timeframe. Mm-hmm. And actually, the CEO of the corporation asked me to put a pitch together about the state of DEI and what it meant and all that. And then locally in our own division, we started focusing on it and we had some events and things like that. I will tell you with the most, I think the best, I would say, intention, we started on that and did work on it quite hard. So that's how, yeah, I came into it and then built some level of, because I'm curious, I kept, you know, asking my team to come up with big data and kind of understand things. Why is it where it is? And things of that nature. And it grew into what I'm doing today.
That's so neat. I want to stay on that topic a little bit before we dive into our office, because you made some really good points there, being not really ever identifying as a female engineer as kind of your primary identity, and then getting that question, how do you feel about being the first C-suite female member at this large, you know, organization? What was it that then had the executive team give you, because you're not an HR function, which is traditionally where we see a lot of DEIB being sort of developed and run out of? What was it that made them pick you, and how did you build a team, given that you were in engineering, product development, technology rather than HR?
So I think it's very simple. I think I just looked the part.
Yeah.
I was the only person of any diversity. I mean, I like, right, to think that maybe I was just like really strategic and I was really, you know, a cool leader and they thought I could do this. But I really think it came down to probably a recognition that is somewhat true, and I'll tell you why I say somewhat. It's somewhat true that when you have lived experience, you are, to some extent, perhaps better prepared to at least understand why, you know, this is an important topic. When I said I didn't identify as a woman, it's not that I didn't experience being a woman. Yes. So as an example, you know, I did experience sexual harassment. And it was very difficult. To be honest with you, I don't think I've ever said this publicly on any conversation. But as it relates to this conversation, you know, it was by a leader that was in a position of authority towards me. I had a small child. I was very young, engineer. I already had levels of responsibility. And it was clear to me that I had only one choice, and that was to change my job. So I did do that. I changed.
Yeah.
Left the job that I really liked, still within that organization, but not under that person's
leader.
You know, sphere of influence. Now, I was an engineer. I was, you know, young. I could do that. I often have reflected since then about people that are subjected to these things and don't have the choices that I had and the opportunities, just because of not just their own background, but just because of the circumstances. You know, an organization that's smaller, that doesn't have as many opportunities. I was in a very large organization. There were many opportunities. So it is not to say that I didn't have the lived experience, right?
Yes.
In those days, you didn't dream of going to HR.
No.
with, you know, information like this. And so I just took it upon myself to put out the word a little bit that I was looking to move. And then I moved very, very quickly. So back to your question, I think it was that it was assumed that I have some lived experience, which was true, but it was not true that I knew how to deal with this. So I started again with what I always say now is start with the data. You know, I'm discharged, you know, I'm an engineer, so I always believe in data. And so I asked, I got a team of volunteers, frankly, which is usually how this is done anywhere, right? I got just kind of asked around who's interested in this. And a few people put up their hands. You know, I had two or three people. And then we had to report to the board every quarter. So we had to put something together. But it's astounding because as it's done in most organizations, even though there was a task at hand and there were some goals, there was an expectation to give briefings and such, there was really no budget.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really, I mean, there was some budget. Again, the organization was doing what most people do even now is, we'll pay for some coffee and cookies, you know, at an event, right? Or maybe a lunch, right? But it wasn't like, here's some budget for some hours that people would spend, or here's, or to go buy a tool or something, you know, to get some data.
Yeah.
The goals were kind of written down in a PowerPoint kind of a slide. There was no project management approach to that. You know, there was just, it was just not treated like anything else that you do in business.
It's really more like a hobby project when it starts out like that than a real business initiative, isn't it?
You know, it has many of the hallmarks, although I know that the leaders didn't think of it that way.
It's right.
Just been
they
historically,
just didn't resource it.
Yeah, it's just been historically treated like something that people can do just because they're passionate, and with the force of your passion and your interest, and you know, you could just absorb it. And instead of the organization going further in their commitment, because again, there wasn't a lack of commitment. I say this, and the reason we started doing this is because of that, because there are many leaders that are aware, that are intentional, that really truly think that having an inclusive environment is a key factor in success of their organization, as it's been shown over and over again now with a lot of data.
Yeah.
But they, but somehow historically, you know, it just hasn't, the ritual hasn't been there, if you will. You know, there's the importance of rituals, like in any
Absolutely.
Community, right? And it's just been, oh, well, you know, we'll anoint somebody as, yeah, it's okay if they spend some part of their time on top of their regular job to do this, you know, at work. And then they'll just sprinkle some fairy dust and, you know, like we'll anoint somebody as a D&I officer part-time yep. or even full-time. But even full-time D&I officers beyond their own, you know, budget for their paying their own compensation, they often are not given much of a budget. And so that's where there's a blind spot, right?
Yeah.
About that. And so that's what we set out to actually address.
So I love the way you've shaped that, Sonia, as far as, you know, a lot of people start these projects with commitment. They believe in it, but not mm-hmm. necessarily with intentionality of resources and how they're going to get it done. What was it maybe for other listeners out there that are getting started on this journey or trying to revamp this journey for their businesses? What was it that allowed you and your small team to kind of be trailblazers at that stage to get into the data? Were you just really good at influencing and encouraging people to give you data, or were you having to go out and create data for yourselves? Like what, where did you kind of make that?
It was both of the above. And by the way, I don't think we were aware of the extent of data that we really needed, because it's all about, you know, connecting the dots. It's fine to say, a lot of times we talk to leaders who say, we have representation data, we have compensation data, we know there's gaps. But we still have trouble retaining. We still have trouble hiring. So true stories, right? It's all about connecting the data. One such organization, very early in our conversations, we said, well, let's look specifically about retention of women. And we said, let's look at your promotion data and let's look at your performance ratings. And let's look at your benefits. The way we look at this, we have dozens of KPIs that are predefined, you know, standard KPIs. And it allows us, in this case, it allowed us to look at the percentage of women that are, you know, overall represented in the organization. Mm-hmm. And then of the people who got the highest performance ratings, what percentage yes. were women? And then of the people who were promoted, what percentage were women? Okay.
Very simple. Yeah. So you're just looking at that.
Yeah. In this case, I mean, to just use some, you know, without attribution, of course, you know, but, and this isn't uncommon. Again, it's not, and it's not intentional, because that fixed very quickly once this awareness and this connection across these data points became apparent to everyone. So we said, look, at you have 30% women, which isn't bad, right, in general, the total. But then when you look at, you know, your performance data, you see that over 40% of your highest performance ratings are women. So women are performing, you know, better at than they're better represented in terms of highest performing than their overall representation. And then when you look at promotions, only 15% of your promotions are women. So let's look at your, you know, promotion process and what factors are considered. There was no need to set a hard and fast requirement or to do anything really extraordinary, because this happened at a period, it happened to be at a period where the promotion cycle and, you know, the annual performance appraisals and things were being done early in the year in the first quarter. And so within the next couple of months, when those decisions were being made, when we looked back, all of a sudden that number had jumped. the promotion number had jumped. And it had, so it was really, but there was transparency about sharing this data with levels of management as needed, so that they became aware of that. And so they kept asking themselves that question as they were making promotion decisions. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I love, I've done some work with a number of D&I professionals over the years, and I love it when you can bring data to the conversation And you said, without attribution, without judgment, you're like, hey, we just found this and we're curious about what. So you went and took a deeper dive into the promotion process. And there's no like root cause analysis. Well, there is root cause analysis, but there's not sort of scapegoating and blame. It's just like it's root cause analysis and what can we do better next?
You know, a portion of my time, of my career, previous career as an engineer and an executive in large corporations was I was chief engineer when I was at TRW. And during that time, that meant that day in and day out, all we're looking at were stuff that didn't work out, basically, right? Stuff that failed, you know, whatever. And root cause corrective action is a huge thing there. And the one thing I found, Dane, over and over again, as we looked at it, was there was never just one thing.
By the way, right?
It was a bad day when something really bad happened because a number of things went wrong. There were always a primary cause and a bunch of secondary causes, especially in the work we did, since most of my background is in aerospace and defense. And obviously those systems have, you know, many bells and whistles, right? I mean, there are you know, there's degrees of protection against failure. So when something fails, there's always, you know, a few things that have happened here and there, right? And we always say the level of safety and quality of any product is really determined at the edges, you know, at the failure points, right? But most of the time it works well. So to me, this is very similar to a workplace environment and the culture and how you're managing your workforce. The majority of the people may be okay, but usually you get into the headlines or something really bad happens and you lose some key talent or your product suffers and your customers are unhappy because there was a number of things that were just maybe not in your main field of view and they were, you know, on the edges, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And there are real consequences. Yep. So I took that approach, frankly, when we were building our office with a number of really talented people that had similar, but in different veins, you know, kind of experiences, intersections with this work. We all tried to build it such that you can really slice and dice and figure out, you know, what is going on with that mindset of this is no different than finding out where are the vulnerabilities, where are the issues that can really bite you.
I love this. And it, what you're saying, if I'm hearing it right, Sonia, is that actually the power of good teamwork and good systems that support teamwork can actually be improved incrementally and worked on every day through that engineering mindset, which is not traditional. When you talk earlier about what HR was, you wouldn't normally go to HR for this. It was more like early days, transactional compliance driven. But now you're actually engineering for optimizing performance, outcomes, safety. Safety is a big one.
Absolutely. I mean, at one time, I was also a leader for quality and safety. So the Lean Six Sigma teams and all this quality things, you know, I had a team for that. And it was the same mindset when you're trying to do these things. You'd never say, let's have some lunch and learns or, you know, and it'll fix everything, right?
Yeah.
And it's astounding that, and again, I don't think it's anyone's fault. I don't think anyone should feel shame. I did that. I did that even with my engineering. I mean, you know, hindsight is 20/20, right?
Yeah.
So for 6-7 years, I was doing just that. So that's why I have so much empathy.
Yes.
And I mean, we're certainly doing what we do. We have passion around making the workplace the most inclusive place for everyone so everyone can belong and be at their best.
Yeah.
That is true freedom. That is the meaning of freedom. That is the meaning of opportunity, you know, and we are the country built on that, right? I'm so proud of that as a first generation American born of immigrant parents. I am so proud. I mean, I know it may sound a little bit lofty, but I'm really think of it that way. I've always been mission oriented. I always went to jobs where it was mission oriented. And to me, this is a mission. You know, what we do at our office is not, you know, a product, a company, a job. It's a mission. Every day is a mission and it has its ups and downs.
Yeah.
But, you know, the bottom line is that you have to be very curious about why people fail despite best intentions. Now, look, there's people that don't believe that workplace culture, how people feel, has anything to do with anything. You know, they'll find out at some point. We're not out to, frankly, turn people around on that. It's a hard thing to do. There's many factors that lead people that way. Big companies make big mistakes. We have examples of, you know, many companies that I could, that we've seen in the news, right? I mean, there's people out there that are like the Robbie Starbucks of the world, and they're getting major companies to make really bad decisions. John Deere, Harley Davidson, Jack Daniels, Ford, even most recently, right? But there are efforts actually against that now, which we can talk about as well if we need to. But bottom line is that it won't be the first time that big companies make mistakes. And that's just, they just will have to find out for themselves. But the moment they decide there's something to this, and they really need to pay closer attention, especially with the Gen Z and the younger generations, then we're here to support them and make sure that they have the data to peel the onion and understand where best to invest to get the best, you know, bang for their bucks in terms of improving inclusion and belonging and their organization's performance and success.
Yeah, I love that. And so this is a great segue to dive right into the platform. And a good starting point for that, you and I were on a call the other day and I asked you about your logo, and I was trying to piece it together. And for any listeners on the show, it's this white sort of outline of what you come to find out from Sonia is Ganesha. And everything that you've just spoken about in this first 20 or so minutes ties into Ganesha, and you can explain it, Sonia, but around, you know, what Ganesha is known for and in removing obstacles. I'd love you to kind of share that story.
Yeah, you know, that logo has many meanings. We actually have a page dedicated to it on our website because it is very meaningful to us. Again, now that I've talked about the mission, you understand this is more to us than, you know, just a company logo, right? So, and it came very naturally. We built the platform, you know, with a team in Pune, in the Maharashtra province in India. They're a great team. They're still good friends of us. And so when we were there, we know that actually Ganesha is the is one of the key deities of that area, actually. But also we learned about, you know, this head of the elephant is known, you know, is a symbol that is for this Hindu god that is, as you said, you know, the remover of obstacles and bringing good fortune. So we thought that was very relevant, but we also thought, you know, it's very relevant because this elephant in the room, right?
Yeah, I love that so, too.
So in many ways, it was, so it symbolizes the removing of obstacles. It is a homage, if you will, to our teammates and partners that are from that area in India. And also it is the elephant in the room. Yes,
I love it. And as you just shared really neatly so far in this conversation, sometimes adding more stuff, adding the lunch and learn or the, you know, special pet insurance or all of these things which are nice and everything else, it just bogs us all down more rather than, hey, let's go and remove obstacles. It just seems like a far more energy creating, you know, accessible, open approach to change in an organization.
You know, Dan, I will say this. We meet everyone that we work with where they are, right?
Yeah.
Again, there's no shame in where anybody is. There is no blame. There is no guilt to feel about this, right? We're all, I mean, you and I have talked about this. You know, I'm a believer of the continuous kind of evolution of the human consciousness, right? And organizations are no different, right? Organizations have a consciousness and they evolve, right? And so if they're doing lunch and learns, if they're doing some, you know, basic good stuff like that, we always tell them to continue that, you know, don't stop that. I mean, it to the extent people are benefiting from it, it's fine. It's just that it's not enough.
Yeah.
You know, and so then most of the time we meet people in one of two cases. We meet people either when they don't know what to do at all. You know, they haven't started really. They've had some, typically people celebrate special months, you know, special days, right?
Yeah.
The events and things. And so they do those good things a few times a year. They have some events, they have some training. And those are all good things. But we try and help really delve into, you know, what are the key drivers of the organization? We always ask, the main question we have is, why are you even interested in improving your workplace culture? What has caused you at this moment in time to become more interested in that?
Yes.
And often, you know, it's something like retention, you know, or hiring. I mean, it's some things that really are critical to the organization's success. Sometimes it's the CMO saying, we've been trying to break into a new market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a beauty very early in our, you know, several years ago, we had a customer that they were a beauty brand and they were like, we just can't seem, you know, we want to expand for men and also for the LGBTQ plus community, from where their products were mostly young women. You know, that those were the customers, right? So there's sometimes things like that. So we've worked with CMOs, you know, with chief marketing officers. So it's not all, you know, HR. We try and have the conversation, the initial conversations at the level of what's important to the whole organization. You know, what is that the, what, you know, what are the drivers of the organization's success over the next 12 to 36 months, you know, at that level. And there's always a connection with, you know, just more innovative ideas, you know, reach out that is more authentic, that feels more authentic. So if you're trying to appeal to men, I mean, we looked around at this organization and we said, well, where are the men in your organization? I mean, everybody who works here seems to be. You know, mostly women, except in a few places we saw a few guys walking around. So sometimes, you know, it's that, right? It's like what you're trying to do outside, you know, you better reflect that inside, right?
Yes.
And so we really try and get down to that and really understand that. And from there, then say, okay, what's the data you have around here? You know, do you have data to understand what that is? You know, if you've looked at, for example, benefits, right? We can't hire anybody. Okay. You don't want to hire women, but we can't hire them. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we look at benefits, and when we have algorithms that score your benefits, and it's a very quick, we make everything quick and easy, by the way. We believe that people are far too busy. If there's one thing that's at a, you know, the most critical resource is just time, right?
Time, yeah.
And more than ever, right? It's always been, but more than ever. So our brand actually is, our office products and services are all built for busy people. So we try to minimize the amount of, you know, time and effort that leaders have to put in and really leverage that time and effort towards where they really have to make a, you know, a strategic input or guidance that they
That's
have
neat.
On their level. But the each is the everyday, you know, because we have a platform, but we also have, you know, packaged with our platform, we always have a dedicated advisor that goes along.
Which I think's phenomenal. I know when you and I met with Lisa and you were explaining, hey, it doesn't matter what state your data's in, we've got the platform, we can take your data and we'll help you find the obstacles and we'll give you this actual human to work with as you start finding those obstacles and planning how to work through them. It's just like, oh, my shoulders dropped.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, this work can't be just done with a tool, right?
Yeah.
You need a human being. I mean, it is human work, right? And also, it's especially important for the second type of organizations we work with. I mean, I talk about the first ones being the ones that are just starting, don't know where to start, don't know anything, what to do. And then there's ones who have actually been working on it and they've reached like a plateau. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have people in between too, but a lot of our customers are in one of these two camps where they've done things on their own, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years sometimes. They've made good progress and now there's still a few issues and they're plateaued and they can tell that they're not progressing. There, it's really important to have a person that says, well, we've had some data, let's add to that, because nobody has the menu of all the KPIs we have.
Yeah.
It's impossible. We just did an analysis for a customer and said, oh, we have this amazing HCM and ATS, and they do. You know, they have two of the best products on the market. And we said, we totally agree with you, but let us show you. And we showed them from our full set of just predefined standard KPIs that are on the platform. And that only added to a little bit less than 50% of all the data they could have.
You know, wow.
The pure HCM and ATS was only 30 plus percent. And then there's another 15% or so of data that comes from their surveys. They do employee experience surveys and so on.
Yep.
That data they have, of course, also. And of course, all that data we bring in and put it all in one place on the platform. So you can connect the dots between what your employee experience survey said, what your benefit scores are, and what your hiring is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It connects all this data across all. But we have a wealth of data that is actually very easily, you know, just from talking to the leaders, you know, and some of and getting into their other data. There's succession planning data. There's mentorship data. You know, how many men do you have mentorship in your company? What does that look like? You know, and all of that we convert into scores for everything.
So you're looking at the score to identify where there's soft spots, but also how a team is progressing over time. Is it both?
Absolutely. So the thing that's really important is also that people sometimes have data that is just a snapshot, but it's really important to look at it historically to see movement that happens when, you know, the levers, the connections, right? So I change benefit, right? Now I have better, parental leave. I've added maternity leave and I've expanded the maternity leave or, you know, whatever, right? It's a simple example. So your scores are improving there. And of course, the effect on hiring and retention is not immediate, but it is very detectable within a short, you know, 2-3 months sometimes. You start seeing the other, curves on the charts for hiring and retention follow in a similar way. You know, if you've improved like something by 20%, you know, it's very interesting how similar it is in the way that it actually the impact is seen.
Absolutely. So in theory, whether you improve your parental leave or you, going back to your early example at GD, you go in and you fix your promotion process, then, you know, 6 months, 12 months later, you're promoting more of the right people. They're excited and more productive themselves, but they're also generating the next group of leaders. So it has to translate to real business results on a number of levels.
And
how do you capture that?
It does. In fact, let me address that in a moment, but I did want to correct one thing. So the promotion and performance ratings example I gave you is unattributed. It is not from my own experience at GD.
Sorry for that.
We don't attribute any data to any company. That's just, it's a company that was, you know, it's one of our early customers actually that saw that.
Got it.
That benefit from seeing the connection between performance ratings and promotion and the women percentage of that. But in terms of how we see that, yes. I mean, when we see the change is made in, the benefits, for example, right? You see the trend, right? The trends are very similar, right? So again, you can see the shapes of the curve are similar, while the magnitude may not be, the absolute numbers may be not the same. And this is no different for people that are familiar, perhaps you are too yourself, is with the, you know, Bloomberg, for example, created I think they call it something like a DEI index, something like that.
Right.
They created it back in 2017, 2018 timeframe, maybe even a little bit earlier. And so you can see if you look at this shape, and I was able to see this actually before we started our company. I actually looked at some of that kind of data. We did quite a bit of research. We did about a year and a half of research and development when we first started the organization. We looked at all the ways people were measuring this, and we incorporated what we found to be most commonly correlated in our platform, and then we added some.
Wonderful.
So with Bloomberg, and I'll come back to answering your question directly about what we have on our platform in terms of business impacts, right? We actually have a category of business metrics on our platform that includes ROIC, return on invested capital, EBIT, earnings before interest and tax, growth, you know, these kind of data on our platform. So you can actually see also the connection and you know, how those key parameters move. ROIC is one of my favorites because very early on in my career as a P&L leader, I some very smart people were invited to share with us that ROIC is the best indicator, at least at that time when I heard this. They were it was the best indicator and correlated with stock price of publicly traded companies. It's not EBIT, it's not EBIT growth, you know. It is actually ROIC. So I've always felt that that is a very important one to take a look at. So we have those parameters, but in the Bloomberg data also, when I, during, as part of our research and development, we found that, and this is, I think, an incredibly good thing with how Bloomberg did it. They built this in a way that, and they built an index, and, you know, building an index is not easy. I mean, you have a number of companies in that index. It's a pretty costly thing to do. So my hat is off to them. And State Street and some others that have, that did that, created some indexes just for DEI. And you can see that the shape of, as the DEI index improves, right, that the, you know, that when you look at the stock prices, you know, of the index companies, that those improve as well. I mean, it is, again, a very parallel kind of a relationship. So, again, we did this with forethought, malice and forethought, as they say, because, you know, we wanted to be sure. Again, I looked at this data, frankly, initially with a healthy level of just curiosity, you know, about whether this is all really true. Is there really that connection? And I would have been the first one to say, for example, just women on boards by itself, you know, we did some of our own analysis by itself at the time we did that analysis, is not one that you could expect to have a significant impact, you know, unless it is followed by that diversity on the board being also through shown through the organization.
Yeah. I'm really glad you shared that, Sonia, because I was having that conversation with my dad earlier in the year. And, you know, at his stage of life, he's sitting there very practically thinking, well, I've seen all of these people appoint diverse board members and their stock prices aren't doing anything different. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not what DEIB is. Like, it's not just board representation. It's what's happening in the organization. So I think some people went for some shortcuts there, sadly. And I think in this moment where there's a little bit of a reset happening and SHRM came out with their you know, removal of equity, and that there's been a lot of noise, and rightfully so, but just getting back to basics of like removing obstacles and helping teams, you know, what does it say? Bring more good fortune to teams, like keep it really simple. And that's going to show out in all of your metrics.
Yeah. And if you have a growth mindset, it shows up, right? That it is, it's good for everybody, right? It's not just benefiting. There's this other myth out there that it is benefiting just one group of people, you know, the underrepresented people, right? And that is just simply not true. I mean, you know, day in and day out, we see now, you know, we've been doing this for the last 5-6 years full time, right? And we've worked with organizations in over 24 industries, right? And with tens of thousands of lives, you know, of employees that are impacted to some extent by this work, right? And we have seen that, you know, it's not just the underrepresented, the historically underrepresented people reporting better experiences. It is also, you know, the majority, you know, if the majority happened to be, and by the way, that's not always the case, right? But if we have global customers, obviously it's not always the case. But if the majority were white males, for example, you know, cisgender white males, they report better experiences.
Oh, 100%. I've seen that with my brother-in-law, white male, better parental policy, had better time for his family. Like it helped everyone. I think it's a great call out.
Yeah. Another customer we had, I'll just tell you one little story. I know we're running short out of time probably, but you know, in terms of creating a safe space, right? Because the other big part, and we talk about data a lot, but I think creating a psychologically safe space is super important. And I'll give you an example that benefited everyone. You know, we have an ability for people to be anonymous and to share things, be their authentic selves and have conversations. And this has huge impact. I mean, frankly, just the day you launch something like this, immediately this level of transparency, trust in your employees and everything already takes the, you know, the level of positivity in the workplace culture up by a couple of notches. And then as people engage, if leaders are engaged, if they communicate with them, that even, you know, that just gets better and better. But in one case, somebody asked just like 2 days before Juneteenth holiday, which just became a holiday, right? Recently, a federal holiday. Somebody at one of the organizations asked their leadership anonymously. They said, well, you know, we're such a, we talk about DEI, but how come we don't have Juneteenth as an off day, you know, as a paid holiday in our company? It's a smaller company, great leader, really intentional, really supportive of this. But, you know, they saw this to their credit, you know. We, of course, we always see these things. We have our advisors, you know, advise as needed. We have the ability to remove a post for them from the feed in case it's offensive or it's really sensitive or something that's not appropriate. So there's all kinds of bells and whistles to protect for things like that. But in this case, and we've never had anyone ask us to remove anything from a feed, by the way, in 6 years, right? But in this case, you know, again, like always, we said, do you want to just answer it privately and remove from feed, or do you want to answer? It was a conversation. To their credit, before the end of the day, they had made that a paid holiday for everyone.
That's awesome. That's
in the organization. Impact. And that's because they had not realized that it was a formal, you know, an official federal holiday yet. I mean, it was new. It was just, you know, about 18 months old, that decision. And they were just hadn't kept up with that and weren't aware of it. So that was, and it was an action like before the end of the day, you know.
That's awesome.
And from henceforth, right? So, I mean, how does that impact everybody, right?
Yeah,
so I always come
back.
That's
good fortune.
Yeah, I mean, but that happens, to be honest with you, over and over again. Yeah. We have, this is what keeps us going.
No, that's a great story. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation, Sonia, and so much that we covered, but I loved sort of the curiosity as a gift and where that started for you in your journey. The importance of, you know, passion and commitment are great, but getting into the data really helps you start to identify where to do the work. I love the way you shared those stories. And that concept coming from engineering around the level of safety is often challenged at the edges. So really thinking through organizations in that setting kind of ties into that final point that you touched on around Juneteenth and, you know, building benefit for all through going in and you know, improving the way that our businesses are running and removing those obstacles. So
and making it sustainable, by the way. I think the only thing maybe we didn't touch upon is the one thing that really added to my disappointment in that role when I had that, I described that I, you know, I hadn't fully succeeded and I didn't know why. We did a lot of good things, right? But not fully succeeded. Yeah. We didn't know why. And then after I left the organization to come back to my home state in California, it started unraveling, you know, and nobody was trying to unravel it. It was just not sustainable because we hadn't built, you know, all
the scaffolding,
the structure. Yep. There was not an infrastructure in place. And again, the way we decided to do this is we're going to make sure that never happens again, and especially as, you know, there's more and more transitions in the workplace, right? And people come and go so that nobody has to start from scratch. You know, none of the good progress made has to be undone.
And that's what this book behind my shoulder here, Systems Leadership, my good friend Ian McDonald says, you know, people are going to come and go, but systems are going to drive sustainable practices. So for anyone that wants to find you and our office and learn about your platform to help them drive that sustainable impact, how do they reach out?
Well, they can just reach out to me if they like. It's Sonia, I spell it with a Y, S-O-N-Y-A, at our office. Also, I think we're going to see if we can make it possible for people who want us to do an assessment for them. We'll be happy to do it, as long, you know, if they're your listeners, Dane, for your listeners,
thank
and
you.
Only for your listeners, we do something that is really the start of everything we do with our customers actually is just an assessment. That assessment, we'll do it complimentary. It gives, an overall rating and 4 subscores and benchmarks in the industry benchmarks for best in class in their industry. So anyone who is really wants to know and, whatever else they do with that is at least they know where they are.
It's a great place to start. No, well, thank you, Sonia. I really appreciate your time. We'll have to do this again sometime soon, and I'm going to try one of those assessments as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dane, for giving me this opportunity. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Thanks, Sonia.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time.